Hi, I'm Patty Daniels. I'm the supervising producer of The World. Often when you think of The World, you might first think about the voices and the reporting you hear on air. It's essential journalism that connects you and helps you understand the world around you. But there is so much more that is going on behind the scenes to make this show work. That means producers, editors, engineers, our whole studio team, all working together to bring you the best journalism with the highest production values. Our team has to be nimble, responsive, and rely on deep experience to make sure the news program you hear each weekday afternoon is the best it can be. We do this work for you. And actually, we can't do this work without you. We have a fundraising goal now through December 31st to raise $67,000 to support our nonprofit newsroom. And we're counting on you to make this campaign a success. Trusted global journalism is already reason enough to give. But here's one more incentive. A generous donor will match your donation one for one. Consider making a gift of $250 to The World. And our newsroom will receive $500 thanks to you and the power of teamwork. Visit theworld.org/give to learn more and make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you. Your gift makes all the difference. And now, here's the show.
The United Nations says loud and clear there needs to be an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, a stance that Israel rejects. Broadly speaking, Israelis support their military's campaign to defeat Hamas.
Israel is trying to destroy a terrorist army government.
We'll also hear from South Lebanon, where people are nervous about a wider war. And in Delhi, the Indian capital, air quality can be bad this time of year, but the current situation is worse than usual.
I have 4 air purifiers in my room right now, so there's a visual for you.
I'm Marco Werman, and good news from Britain you didn't know you needed. Fiona the sheep is safe and freshly sheared.
I absolutely took my time. I've never been as nervous shearing a sheep when I know that the whole world is going to look at it after I'm finished.
Why Fiona the sheep became famous this weekend, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to have you with us today. Multiple officials at the UN today are describing the death toll in the Gaza Strip as horrific. The Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza says that more than 10,000 people have been killed since the start of the Israeli military campaign, and that more than 4,000 of them are children. Communications in Gaza went down again today. The Israeli military said it hit 450 targets overnight. The Israel Defense Forces say its ground troops are fighting Hamas militants in the northern Gaza Strip. This war began almost a month ago, as you'll recall, when Hamas attacked Israel, killing 1,400 people. In the past weeks, political divisions in Israeli society have been coming to the forefront. This weekend, angry demonstrators clashed with police outside the official residence of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. They were calling on him to resign and secure the return of hostages that were taken by Hamas. We've reported on massive protests against Netanyahu for nearly a year now, but these protesters are motivated by a new anger since the Hamas attack of October 7th. We reached out to David Horovitz, editor-in-chief of the Times of Israel in Jerusalem.
The protesters themselves, they don't always have the same agenda. Broadly speaking, of course, they want their loved ones returned. There are protesters who think that that could best be achieved by some kind of ceasefire or temporary ceasefire in the fighting. There are others who think that that is the opposite, that that in fact would give Hamas time to reorganize and so on. And then the protests against Netanyahu had been set aside for the past month. And in fact, the main organization that was orchestrating those protests became central to the civilian effort to help southern Israel and the people of southern Israel. And it's only in the last few days that some of these protests against Netanyahu have resurfaced, as you say, in the middle of a war.
How much do these demands for Netanyahu to resign resonate across the political spectrum in Israeli society?
They're there, but they're not the story. And the story in Israel for the last month, absolutely emphatically right now as well, is that we are in a war. It's a war, as one former general put it, in Gaza, which is the largest fortress, this general said, ever made, ever in the history of the world. Israel is trying to destroy a terrorist army government that is continuing to fire rockets at Israel. That, as far as Israelis are concerned, is, there's a growing body of global public opinion that seems to have forgotten what happened on October the 7th, which is people murdered in their homes, slaughtered in amid horrific atrocities in their own country by terrorists who came in from Gaza, where Israel withdrew, has no territorial claims on Gaza. And Israel is now trying to make sure that Hamas cannot do that again. It's trying to deter a more powerful terrorist army, Hezbollah in the north and the orchestrator, Iran. It's trying to deter those more potent enemies from thinking that they can attack Israel. And it's trying to restore some sense of security for Israeli civilians. So there is a great deal of anger against the political leadership and the military leadership, but that is marginal compared to the demands of a war that is far from won, and where Israelis feel that their army is now doing what needs to be done while trying to minimize civilian fatalities in Gaza in an international climate of growing criticism of an Israel that is trying to restore the capacity of Israeli civilians to live safely in their country.
On the point that we've heard from Israeli leaders, they say the goal with this military campaign is to defeat Hamas. What do you think that means, David? What's the longer-term goal here for the Gaza Strip?
It's not clear what this Israeli government would want to do with Gaza. You know, this is a government that includes very far-right politicians, some of whom would like Israel to return to Gaza, which it left in 2005 unilaterally. I don't think that the thrust of the Israeli mainstream, if the war can be won in the terms that I said, if Hamas can be defanged, I don't think there'll be a mass middle ground Israel that says, hey, we want to stay in Gaza. Netanyahu himself has been quite vague on this, but he's been very critical of the Palestinian Authority, which, of course, is the alternative to Hamas.
UN leaders say the Gaza war must stop now, David, as reported death tolls top 10,000. Is time running out?
It's good that you say reported death tolls. The only people reporting the death toll from Gaza are the Hamas-run health ministry, which has, I'm not going to be polite here, a record of absolutely no credibility in terms of what is going on and who is being killed. We don't know where Hamas gets that figure from. We don't know what to make of it. But for sure, people are being killed in Gaza. You know, the Israeli political leadership makes the point that it tries to keep its people safe. It has rocket alarms and safe rooms and failed to keep its people safe on October the 7th, whereas it says Hamas is deliberately keeping people in harm's way in Gaza, reportedly even trying to prevent people from northern Gaza from using humanitarian corridors, one was open again today, to escape the fighting. But in terms of the second part of your question, the UN calling for a ceasefire, lots of people calling for a ceasefire, Israel's position and the United States' position to date is, well, no. Try to minimize civilian fatalities for sure, but this is a terrorist army that rules the place next door, that burst into your country and killed loads of people. And you have the right, or as Tony Blinken said in Tel Aviv on Friday, the obligation to ensure that it doesn't happen again.
David, finally, can you assess for us the pressure from people who think Benjamin Netanyahu should resign, combined with the pressure of over 200 hostages whose lives are at risk, who need to be released, while the prime minister is still prosecuting and will be for the foreseeable future what happened on October 7th? How do you see these three coinciding things potentially affecting the arc of the war against Hamas?
I don't think that that pressure is going to rise to the point where Netanyahu is forced out. I don't think that Netanyahu is going to step down. I think he will try to, as you put it, you know, prosecute this war. He's certainly saying that's what he intends to do, and he'll face the consequences of everything that occurred prior to it after the war. And again, I stress to you, the main focus in Israel, even among many people who have no time for Netanyahu, to put it mildly, is we're in a war here against a horrifically monstrous enemy, and that needs to be dealt with first.
David Horowitz is the editor-in-chief of the Times of Israel. He joined us from Jerusalem. Thank you very much, David, for being with us.
Thank you.
In northern Israel today, more fighting with Lebanon. This weekend, civilians on both sides of that border were killed. These back-and-forth clashes have gone on for weeks, raising concerns that the Gaza war could spread. As a precaution, thousands of civilians on both sides of the border have evacuated their homes. Rebecca Collard reports from South Lebanon.
This is high tension region. High tension. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is under bombing. This is high tension.
In a municipal building in the coastal city of Tyre, Mayor Hassan Dabouk explains a map of South Lebanon on the wall. Here, the country's looming war is color-coded. Red areas have been hit frequently by Israeli strikes. Yellow, what Dabouk calls high tension. And blue, the areas he fears people will soon be trying to flee.
This is the present situation.
On a screen nearby, Lebanon's displacement is tracked. Tyr is hosting around 8,000 people, and it's in the yellow zone, meaning now it's a place to shelter. But soon, it could be a place to flee. Nearby, a college campus has been turned into a makeshift shelter for families fleeing the border fighting. Next to notices about tuition fees and grade breakdowns, aid groups have now plastered posters. Outside, laundry hangs on the college's main gates. 2 weeks ago, Ahmed Nasser fled here with his family.
They were, you know, kids get afraid and they start screaming. And it was dangerous because they felt very close in the sound.
Nasser and his family lived through the 2006 war with Israel, stuck in the south. He describes how his children would scream and cry at the sound of bombing, the fear that he couldn't protect them. It was 2 weeks before there was a pause in the fighting and they were able to escape north.
Oh, my kids and us and everyone were living in fear, so the fear is still there.
This time, when strikes hit just a few hundred yards from his home while they were eating dinner, Nasser immediately put his kids in the car and drove north. They brought almost nothing, and they don't know when they'll be able to go home. Their village is just half a mile from the border, but even here in this shelter, 10 miles from the border, he can hear the thud of strikes in the distance.
All of them who have kids, like, took them and left.
But not everyone is making that choice. Zeynab Arzouni is studying to be a doctor. She lives less than a mile from the Israeli border and says in recent weeks she has slept to the sound of bombing.
We took the decision that we are not leaving our home if everything happens.
Really?
Yeah, we are not leaving. It's really hard, like, to leave and to fled and to move on.
Arzouni was just 6 months old when her parents fled with her to Syria to escape the 2006 war.
They have that bad experience. They told me a lot of stories to how we fled to Syria, to how they protected me. It was really hard. I was a newborn. She was breastfeeding me. Like, I was totally newborn. I was in my diapers, you know.
And they don't want to live through that again. So they are preparing the best they can to stay in their home.
So we go bring groceries and stuff like that, you know, vegetables, fruits, and some cans, yeah.
In 2006, there was no warning. Hezbollah kidnapped two Israeli soldiers, and hours later, they were in the midst of a full-scale war with Israel.
After 1 week of the beginning of the 2006 war, everyone was in need. You can buy nothing. There is no goods in the market. Everyone, she was in need just to provide only the food and the drinking water. And after 10 days, it was impossible to find your medicine, even you have the money.
Mayor Dabouk and his team of city employees, members of the Lebanese Red Cross and volunteers, watch the latest news from Gaza, the destroyed buildings and children being pulled from the rubble of their homes.
What is the thing that you're most worried about right now?
It's the people, the babies, the women, the vulnerable people, poor people, children. This is what, because what we are seeing in Gaza, something unbelievable. This large number of elder people and super huge number of the babies and the small. It's very, very, very hard even.
So for you, the worst case scenario is that South Lebanon looks like Gaza. Like, this is what the fear is, that you end up in a situation like them.
No.
No?
No. I think Israelis cannot do what they are doing in Gaza and South Lebanon, because here the resistance will be more and more and more hard than Gaza, because their capacity of the resistance here, it's more than Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
will be very expensive for everyone. They will not win, let's say, from the military point of view. But the losses there will be will stop them to bomb here.
Most Lebanese lived through the 2006 war, and many through the country's 15-year civil war as well, not to mention the blast in Beirut in 2020 that may have been the world's largest ever non-nuclear explosion. But the difference is this time there is warning that danger may be coming, and that means the chance to prepare, but also difficult choices to be made with little certainty about what happens next.
We are hoping for peace, for a fair peace, for justice, because always in the wars, the victims are the civilians. The civilians are the victims.
But Dabouk and most Lebanese will have no say if there's war or peace. That decision will be made by Israel and Hezbollah. For the world, I'm Rebecca Collard in Tyre, South Lebanon.
Want to dive into how technology and Black spirituality intersect? Or confront the challenges new tech is creating? Maybe even catch a vision of hope for the future?
Check out Moral Repair, a Black exploration of tech. A podcast about the innovations that make our world and break our societies.
And how we can all heal just a bit. Available on Spotify, Apple, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Darren.
And I'm Esther.
And this is Second Sunday, a podcast about Black queer folk finding, keeping, and sometimes losing faith.
This season's full of candid conversations. We're talking to theologians, artists, activists, and community members living at the intersections of faith, spirituality, and identity.
The saints ain't ready for this.
But we're still going to talk about it.
Second Sunday. Find it wherever you get podcasts.
Second Sunday is a Cube original podcast and is part of the PRX Big Questions Project.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Spanish politics are in limbo. When Spain held elections back in July, no single political party won an outright majority. Now the ruling socialists have a plan for putting together a government coalition, and this is where things get controversial. The socialist plan hinges on Catalan independence parties being part of that coalition. The problem for Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez is what the Catalans want in exchange for participating: amnesty for their failed breakaway attempt from Spain 6 years ago. They're looking for another go at independence. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona.
Much to Prime Minister Sanchez's chagrin, the Catalan separatists, led by exiled leader Carles Puigdemont, are a problem that just won't go away.
L'1 d'octubre no va ser un delicte.
Our independence referendum was not a crime, Puigdemont said recently from exile in Brussels. He was referring to the unconstitutional vote he led 6 years ago. Nor were our mass protests against government repression, he said. Catalonia's independence referendum came after years of stalled talks between the region and Madrid over taxes, language rights, and more. The vote itself was declared illegal by Spain's highest court. Spanish police cracked down on voters, dragging them from polling stations and beating many. Puigdemont fled in the night over the Pyrenees. Up until just a few weeks ago, his demeanor was that of a guy on the lam, worried about extradition. These days, he's holding forth like a kingmaker, with demands. First up, amnesty from prosecution. This was, until recently, a thing of dreams. What Puigdemont wants is amnesty, Prime Minister Sanchez said on TV less than a year ago. This government isn't going to accept that idea, he said. It's not even allowed under the Spanish Constitution. But here's the song Sanchez is singing now.
En el nombre de España, en el interés de España, en defensa de la convivencia entre españoles, defiendo hoy...
In the name of Spain, he told fellow socialists last week, and to foster peaceful coexistence, I support amnesty in Catalonia for those implicated during the independence movement. Sanchez's about-face puts him way out on a political wire, because polls show that while most Catalans support amnesty, the rest of Spain does not. This is not lost on the guy who actually got more votes in July than Sanchez, conservative Popular Party leader Alberto Feijóo. Problem for Feijóo was no one wanted to team up, except for the far-right Vox party, but it wasn't enough to reach 50%. But now Feijóo smells political blood. He's been leading giant crowds against amnesty for the separatists, rallying behind national unity, the flag. This was an outdoor rally last week in the southern city of Málaga.
Los que delinquieron han de ser juzgados y los que no hemos delinquido no tenemos que pedir perdón a nadie.
Those who broke the law, Feijó told the crowd, must be judged. And those of us who are not delinquents do not have to ask forgiveness of criminals. That, he said, is undemocratic. The most recent polls suggest Feijó's strategy is working. As the socialists and the separatists inch closer to a deal, the conservative leaders' numbers are rising. And the worst for Sánchez might be yet to come. Exiled Catalan leader Puigdemont summed it up himself.
O repeteix eleccions, o pacta amb un partit que manté la legitimitat de l'1 d'octubre.
Either the country holds elections all over again, he said in Brussels, or Sánchez's government makes a pact with us, the same party that will never renounce our legal and legitimate right to secede from Spain. To wit, if Puigdemont does sign along Sánchez's dotted line, sooner or later, he's going to demand that Sánchez cross a red one of his own to negotiate a legal vote on Catalan independence. But that would require amending the constitution, not to mention likely sparking even larger national protests. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
Believe it or not, this has been a big news story in the UK recently.
A sheep in the Scottish Highlands, dubbed Britain's loneliest sheep, may have to spend the winter alone after animal welfare chiefs said there's no plans to mount a rescue operation.
Well, the ewe, now known as Fiona, was first seen stranded at the bottom of a cliff 2 years ago. On Saturday, a group of farmers with supervision from the Scottish SPCA hauled her up a steep embankment. Cammy Wilson organized a rescue. He joins us from Ayrshire. So this worked. I know you organized a rescue. Tell us what you did on Saturday.
Yeah, so myself and four other idiots, as I describe us, headed up to the Highlands with a couple of ropes and a big canvas feed sack that we use for feeding our sheep. And we climbed down this cliff face and found Fiona. And after getting a hold of her very easily, she was super calm. And after a lot of panting and struggling, we managed to get her around 30 metres up the slope to where the end of the rope was. Got her into the sack, nice and comfortable. Of course, she had 3 years' worth of wool around her, so she was floating up the cliffside, wrapped up in a mattress, and it was nice and comfortable for her. So we used a winch at the top to get her up there.
Incredible. So you called yourself and your friends who did this a bunch of idiots. I think that might be understandable once you describe the terrain. Why was she stuck there and so hard to retrieve?
Yeah, we think she's fallen down there as a lamb. And the reason that became such a big thing and no one was going to get her is because, due to health and safety and the danger, no employer could really send their employees down there. It was so dangerous, whereas when you're on your own and you're just full hardy and on a mission, it's fine. There's nobody to blame except yourself.
The pictures of Fiona, her fleece, as he said, thick as a mattress, enormous. How did that change your rescue strategy?
Yeah, the size of her, of course, and the weight. We did consider shearing her at the bottom to take some of the weight off and make it a bit easier to get her up. But the issue there was, once she'd shorn her, she wouldn't have that protection of the fleece for bringing her up. You know, there's a few jagged rocks and trees sticking out and various obstacles, of course. And she was essentially being slid up in this bag. So by leaving the fleece on her, it kept her over that 100 kilogram mark. But it did mean that she had great protection.
So I'm curious, how much did she weigh before the shearing once you got Fiona back up to the top of the cliff, and how much did she weigh after?
Now, she was wet when we brought her up, but when she dried out, she was 101 kilos with the wool on and 92 kilos with the wool off. So 9 kilos of wool we took off her, and we used the old school hand shears to get that wool off her.
Well, according to my rapid conversion tables, Fiona dropped from 231 pounds to 202 pounds after that shearing. That's incredible.
There we go.
Wow.
Yes, definitely.
I know you professional sheep shearers can work pretty fast, but how long did it take?
That was 14 minutes. I absolutely took my time. I've never been as nervous shearing a sheep when I know that the whole world is going to look at it after I'm finished.
Beauty salon for Fiona. You want her to look good.
Absolutely.
So how's she being cared for right now? Where is Fiona?
So she's now went to a fantastic place called Dulscone Farm Fun. It's a farm park for around 5 months of the year, and the rest of the time it's closed to the public through the winter. So it's closed just now. There won't be any public there until April, and she'll be live on Facebook virtually every day. They have a huge American following, I must say. There's a lot of fans over in the US. in Canada and the rest of North America. So I dare say some people might have heard of them, and hopefully they'll be able to see her even more on there.
Cammie Wilson, sheep shearer and broadcaster, updating us on the rescue of Fiona, nicknamed the UK's loneliest ewe. Cammie, thanks very much for speaking with us and for organizing Fiona's rescue.
Thank you. Great fun. Thanks.
You're listening to The World. In Sydney, Australia, there's a building with a dark past, a police station where gay men were once jailed and abused. Now it's a museum for the community that was mistreated there.
We are here, we're queer, and we survived. So goodbye, good luck, this is now ours.
From a site synonymous with homophobia to Queer History Central. That story's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. What do Boeing, the Portland International Airport, and some of the cheapest electricity in America have in common? If you said the Columbia River, then you are correct. All three depend on harnessing the power of the Columbia River, which is why there is a lot of attention on negotiations between the U.S. and Canada. Those talks are focused on how Canada manages the dams along parts of the river north of the border. From British Columbia, Jimmy Thompson reports.
The Columbia River begins high in the mountains of British Columbia, then flows more than 1,000 miles, half the length of the Mississippi, through Canada and into central Washington, where it feeds rich agricultural valleys. Finally, it hits Portland, then empties into the Pacific. It's a lot of water, and it used to pose serious risks for the towns on its banks.
18,000 are rendered homeless within the hour. Scores perish in the floodwaters despite the efforts of quickly mobilized rescue workers.
That was in 1948. The Columbia River breached a levee in Vanport, Oregon. It destroyed the whole town. More than 50 people died. The flood kick-started talks between Canada and the U.S. about how they could control the river and benefit from it. Eileen Delahanty-Perks is a historian whose book A River Captured is about the history of the river. She says the Columbia River has been called a dream landscape for hydro engineers.
Because of the steep sides of the valleys, the high mountains, and those narrow passages that occur from time to time, it was an ideal place to slap up some concrete.
But that concrete has created controversy for decades. In 1961, Canada and the U.S. signed the Columbia River Treaty. Both countries built dams on their sides of the border, which provided electricity and flood control. It also allowed for a ton of development downstream. Even the Portland Airport was built on what was formerly a dangerous floodplain. In return, Canada would get paid in cash every year. But that's never been good enough for many Canadians. They say the money doesn't make up for the land lost to the reservoirs. Some of the land was irreplaceable.
A lot of it was occupied by old growth forests.
Greg Utzig is an ecologist who has studied what the dams did to the land.
If you think of the most productive, largest old growth forests existing in the valley bottoms in British Columbia, of which there are hardly any left in the interior, that's what it was.
It wasn't just forests that were flooded, but farmland too. Photographer Steve Shannon has documented some of the damage near his home in Nicusp.
You're talking an area that was as productive or could have been more productive than the orchards and wineries of the Okanagan. That could have been this and then some. But instead we're looking at a vast expanse of nothing.
Shannon says he talked to families who lost everything, and in many cases, what they received in return was less land, of lower quality.
It broke people. Like, it broke their spirit.
Under the current Columbia River Treaty, the U.S. pays Canada about $300 million a year. Some of that money has been used to fund skill building, energy retrofits, habitat conservation, even soccer teams. But the treaty expires next year. And some stakeholders in the U.S. say Canada should not keep getting that money. That's because the ongoing payments Canada receives are actually from electricity produced in the U.S. As part of the treaty, the U.S. sends that electricity to Canada. Canada then turns around and resells it back to the U.S., which is a bigger energy market. Power utilities in the U.S. say it's unfair for their customers to be stuck with the bill.
This power should be used for the economic development and the well-being of the public servants, the farmers, and the vulnerable communities that we serve.
Ryan Redmond is the CEO of Benton REA, a nonprofit power utility in Washington. He spoke at a recent listening session held by the U.S. State Department.
These benefits are clearly skewed in favor of the Canadians, regardless of the intention of the treaty.
But according to U.S. government stats, Washington customers pay some of the lowest rates in the country. Also on the bargaining table, salmon. First Nations and Native American tribes have called for more water to be released downriver when salmon need it for spawning. In the current treaty, Canada doesn't control the river's flow. Historian Delahanty Perks thinks of the dams as bathtubs.
And the Americans control the spigots. And Canadians live around the edges of those bathtubs with no power about when they fill or empty.
Ecologist Greg Utzig says what the indigenous groups are asking for could mean generating less power and less money.
We want to maintain payment for the downstream benefits we're providing, obviously. But at the same time, we also want more flexibility in the way we operate the dams that we can make these gains back in Canada.
But there's no way to gain back what was lost, says photographer Steve Shannon. From the mucky ground that's left when the water is sent downstream to generate power to the cracked foundations of homes that were moved uphill.
I don't know. How do you put a price on this? And how do you say that you're done? Like, we're never getting this land back.
The next round of formal negotiations hasn't been scheduled, but negotiators say they're meeting weekly to land on an agreement in principle. For The World, I'm Jimmy Thompson in Nelson, British Columbia.
There is no school in New Delhi this week. Air pollution in India's capital is so bad that schools are shut so children can stay home for their health. Air pollution in New Delhi is 100 times worse than the World Health Organization's recommended limit. Jaidar Gupta is a clean air activist. He's in New Delhi. What's it like to take a deep breath outside right now, Jaidar?
You know, it's actually really dark and gray outdoors. Just looking at it, I mean, forget taking a breath. Of course, the air is very, very heavy with particulates, both PM10 and PM2.5. You already mentioned that we're 100 times the WHO limit, and that's about, you know, just about accurate, actually. So just off the charts of everything. It's related to farming. It's related to the winter setting in and the air, you know, what we call the cold air conversion. So this is an annual event. I think our children are quite used to it, and it's really unfortunate. This is not something that is a natural calamity or a natural emergency.
If you say, Jaidar, that this is totally predictable, what is contributing to the bad air quality?
There's a whole lot of sources, right? There's, you know, the biomass burning, which is a big problem, also related to poverty, because about 50% of India still lights their cooking stoves using some form of biomass, mostly wood. And so we have a state of Punjab, which borders Pakistan. So it's on the northwestern border of India with Pakistan, which grows a particular variety of rice. And they burn the residue that's left in the ground after the harvest. And you'll see a red ball of fire, and the winds are out of the northwest. So up until 4 days ago, these winds were blowing from India into Pakistan. So all of Lahore and Islamabad and Peshawar were smoked. And now the wind directions changed 4 days ago, and all of our smoke is blowing into New Delhi and beyond. I mean, the smoke blows all the way across India into Kolkata, which is the eastern part of India, and also into Bangladesh.
I mean, one of the things that seems to make this pollution predictable is the harvest, which typically happens around this time of year when, as you say, biomass waste in crop fields is burned. So how much is that really the central part of this problem?
Well, currently where I sit, about 30% of the smoke of that AQI is contributed to the farm fires. So 30% of it is coming from outside, 70% of it is local. And so, you know, my thought is, okay, so we have a federal government and a state government that do not want to engage with farmers because that's the vote bank. Let's deal with the 70% that's local. But 8 years, same Delhi government, we're not getting any action. People are frustrated.
Back to this headline of children being kept inside and out of school in New Delhi. How unusual is that?
It's not really unusual for a child in Delhi. Again, as I said, it's an annual event. I mean, the first protocol when the AQI exceeds 200 is limit activity and exposure. And it's hard to let children out of the house and expect them to limit activity and exposure. It's not going to happen. Children want to bounce around. They want to play. And also the worst part of the day when the air is absolutely toxic and poisonous is between 7 a.m. and 10 a.m. when the air is really, really cold and the wind speeds are really low. And that's the time the child is leaving from the house to go to school. So, you know, as a parent, I kind of get behind that science that, you know, going to school is a no-no. Our schools
are mostly open schools. They're not closed environments. They don't have air purification systems. They don't have the health and safety compliance required for this.
Is there any immediate remedy that you think has not been tried that, you know, officials really need to think about?
The immediate remedy is to go after all the sources of pollution and just cut human activity down. So vehicles should be off the road and all of public transportation should be made free. All the emissions need to be monitored and all the emissions need to be monitored real time. There's a lot of industry. There's a lot of thermal power plants around the national capital. All of that needs to be brought into some kind of compliance mode. But we need to really go after all the sources of emissions. Now, the government is, you know, coming in and doing another odd even from the 13th to the 20th, which is, you know, on every alternate day, there'll be an odd car with an odd license registration number or an even one. So about 50% of the cars will be plying each day.
I see. So they're staggered
like
every other day.
Yeah. Really doesn't make sense, because when you've got the kind of crisis that we have right now, you just got to shut it all down.
Jaidar Gupta is a climate activist advocating for clean air in India. He joined us from New Delhi, which has told children to stay home from school this week. That's how bad the air is there. Jaidar, thank you very much. I hope you can stay indoors for a few days.
Yes, thank you very much.
Sydney, Australia is getting a new LGBTQ museum dedicated to the country's queer history and culture. It will be housed in the notorious Darlinghurst Police Station, a building with a dark history. 4 decades ago, this was a place where gay men and lesbians were arrested and beaten. The founders of the museum believe the location can be transformed from a place of violence and trauma into one of healing and even celebration. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports from Sydney that not everyone agrees. And a warning to listeners, the story contains descriptions of violence.
It was just past 10 o'clock on June 24th, 1978, and Peter Murphy, a young activist with the Gay Solidarity Group, was about to head out to join the crowds. The gay community in Sydney was marking the anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising in New York.
We came up with the idea of a street party late at night, and this was a big innovation for us. But San Francisco had something to do with that. And, yeah, it was really a fun crowd. You know, there was the music was playing, people were in costume and makeup and dancing. But somehow or other, in the middle of it all, the police had decided to really use it for a confrontation.
As the crowd surged down the street, they had no idea what was waiting for them.
When we reached the end of the main drag there, it's near a police station. The police were there in force. They had us surrounded. In fact, all side streets were packed with these police, and then they drove into the front of us as we were marching out.
Police officers removed their badges and began kicking, shoving and punching.
They had a vehicle with very bright lights. That's what I remember so clearly, that this incredibly bright light just blinded us. And I could see bodies just flying, silhouetted against the lights.
Murphy and 52 other protesters were arrested and taken to the Darlinghurst police station. Inside, he was separated from the others, and he says he was turned into an example.
Everyone was taken into the police station and put into the dock or into a cell. And then they came back and got me and took me to a different part of the police station, and I can't talk about it. Just...
yeah.
One policeman did the beating and screaming his head off in a massive rage, and the other one was just calmly watching. So I think to make sure he didn't kill me.
I went to the Darlinghurst police station on a recent afternoon. The fortress-like building in red brick and sandstone is at the heart of the gay community. A rainbow pride flag flutters next to it. The building's no longer a police station. It was decommissioned in 1987, and it will soon be the home of the city's new queer history center, Qtopia Sydney. Greg Fisher, the museum CEO, meets me at the door and takes me through the building.
So we've now just entered the foyer of the former Darlinghurst police station, which we now call Qtopia Sydney. So just as soon as you walk in, there's going to be the pink triangle here on the floor. And etched around the pink triangle will be a black triangle for trans people.
The museum will tell the story of the LGBTQ rights movement in Australia. It will also host events, lectures, and concerts, and will be a gathering place for the community. Fisher leads me down a narrow hallway.
We're now in a cell. This is one of three cells that was, in fact, used to house the women. You're feeling claustrophobic. I can see it.
Yeah, and they're just us.
That's
here.
Right. Yeah.
At one point during that night in 1978, the police crammed 24 women in here and left them for hours.
Yeah, I mean, the history in Australia is not dissimilar to the history in America. It was a period of time before 1984 where to be a homosexual was a crime. And there were police who took great delight in enforcing the law.
With relish, yeah.
With relish.
The decision to house a museum in the former police station wasn't taken lightly, says Fisher. He acknowledges the location is fraught and says that's the point. He believes Qtopia can reclaim this building.
This is a f*** you moment. We are here, we're queer, and we survived. So goodbye, good luck. This is now ours.
But Peter Murphy, who was beaten so badly in the Darlinghurst police station that he went into convulsions, says he will never set foot in here again.
I can't, because of all of the emotion that's really caught up in that site. You know, you don't want to erase the memory entirely of what took place, but you don't have to do it at the Darlinghurst police station.
Murphy says this building is too tainted by a history of violence. He's part of a group that represents some of the original 1978 protesters, and several months ago, they called on Qtopia and the New South Wales government to halt the project for more community consultation.
The Darlinghurst police station is really a torrid sort of location from my own personal experience, of course, but for many, many people. So to think you can easily transform it is probably a bit naive.
Qtopia is forging ahead over these objections. Renovations on the building are underway, and the center is slated to open in February. Many in the LGBTQ community are on board, including some activists who remember being hauled here in the back of a police wagon. But from Peter Murphy's perspective, there's only one good option when it comes to this place.
Destroy it, and then something better could happen there.
For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum in Sydney.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Vladimir Putin says Russia is winning the war in Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says they are winning the war. But the top military commander for Ukraine, Valery Zaluzhny, raised some eyebrows when he told The Economist recently that the war is at a stalemate. Zaluzhny's remarks have provoked a debate over what exactly is happening on the ground and how each side is positioned. Arkady Ostrovsky is the Eastern Europe editor for The Economist. He's the one who interviewed Zaluzhny about the war. He joins us from London. Arkady, based on your conversation, bird's eye view, what's going on with the war in Ukraine militarily?
Well, what's going on is pretty clear that after 5 months of the counteroffensive, which began on the 4th of June, Valery Zaluzhny told us that Ukrainian army has only progressed by 17 kilometers. That's way short of the expectations of a breakthrough, which both Ukrainian commanders and the allies hoped for when the counteroffensive began. It has been actually clear to us for some time that the two militaries have sort of reached this stalemate. And in Zaluzhny's view, Russian and Ukrainian armies have reached kind of the level of parity, if you like, when neither side has a technological advantage, where both armies see exactly what the enemy is doing on the battlefield. And as soon as Russian armor enters the kill zone that's within the artillery range of Ukrainian forces, it just gets demolished, which is why the Russians couldn't advance either. It took Russian forces about 10 months to take a small town called Bakhmut, which is 6 by 6 square kilometers. So Zaluzhny basically said, this is where we are. And unless Ukraine gets more weapons, until Ukraine reaches air superiority, where it can deny Russian air defense system and can deny Russian drones, and it's very unlikely that Ukraine could make a significant advance, which means basically that we're now in a positional sort of fight. I mean, he described it in terms of the First World War, which is very, very striking, where neither side can advance very much. And the war is entering this stage of attrition, which is clearly disadvantageous to Ukraine. It's one quarter of Russia's size. Its economy is one tenth of Russia's. It doesn't have the oil and gas resources. So Zaluzhny is really pressing the allies to step up military support.
There has been advanced technology from the West, though, that Ukraine's military has received. So why hasn't there been a bigger breakthrough with the counteroffensive? Did Zaluzhny have any explanations for that?
Some of it came too late, and it wasn't the latest stuff that Ukraine was getting. You know, in a NATO doctrine, no NATO army would attempt such a counteroffensive without air cover. Now, Ukraine didn't have that air cover. Ukraine doesn't have long-range missile systems that would outshoot the Russian systems, because the American and European leaders are worried about this escalation risk. They're worried about supplying Ukraine with the systems that could lead to, as somebody once said to me, sort of catastrophic defeat of Vladimir Putin. Now, as a professional military in any country, including and particularly in the US, would say those two words should not belong in the same sentence, catastrophic defeat. You know, if Ukraine is to achieve success and victory in this war, then that does mean, the corollary of that does mean that Putin will be defeated. And I think it's this sort of self-restraint that, and Vladimir Putin has managed to make use of Russian nuclear, not by actually exploding it on the battlefield, but by using it as a scare tactic. And it I'm afraid it has sort of worked.
Ukraine has recently used long-range missile systems, three of them, in fact, to strike deep into Crimea. Is that the kind of stalemate breaker General Zaluzhny is asking for, just more of it?
Yes. And in fact, General Zaluzhny has been Zaluzhny is a real thinker. When we talked, you know, he talks about war in terms of military science and military art. He has been very consistent in saying that Crimea is the center of gravity of this war, and it's Putin's greatest vulnerability. Now, it's the center of gravity because that's how Russia supplies its army in Ukraine, through Crimea. And it's Putin's greatest vulnerability politically because his entire revisionist, restorationist project is based in bringing back Crimea, the symbol of the Russian Empire. That is his so far biggest success. That's where his political legacy lies. And so if he starts losing Crimea and Crimea is drawn in the war, as it is already effectively, because as you said, you know, Ukraine is able to strike deep in Crimea. Putin doesn't admit this, of course, to the Russian people. But that is the greatest vulnerability politically, and it's very important militarily because that's how Russia supplies the front.
Arkady, it's been a few days since your interview with Ukraine's top military leader was released. What has been the reaction and debate you've seen since then?
Yes, the reaction has been, I really didn't expect the splash it's made. The splash was caused not just by what Zaluzhny said, because as we discussed, we knew pretty much that the front was the stalemate. It was caused by the fact that he said it openly at this point in time. The reaction has been, there's been reaction in the US, in Russia, in less so in Europe, perhaps. In America, I thought it was very interesting how polarizing, in a way, this interview and Zaluzhny's article has been. The White House commented on it, as have some former US military, saying this is very honest and frank assessment of the situation, and this only proves how much we need to step up, and this only is a proof that why the Biden administration wants the Congress to approve this large package. The Trumpists, the isolationists, of course, jumped in saying, well, this is the proof why we shouldn't be sending armor to and money to Ukraine, because clearly they're at a stalemate. It's not going to make any difference. It's a waste of money. Putin rubbed his hands, I think, somewhat and said, no, this is not true. We're not at stalemate. Russia is advancing. Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, said also, no, we're not in a stalemate, we're advancing. But Zaluzhny is a man who is dealing with facts on the ground, and he can't afford to get trapped in that narrative, however comforting that narrative might be. In order to win this war, he needs to deal with reality.
Arkady Ostrovsky is the Economist editor for Eastern Europe. Arkady, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow. Marco here. Before we go, just a reminder that right now the World is holding our fall fundraising drive. Your support is critical. It powers our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting. Our goal is to raise $67,000 before the end of the year. Every gift counts. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and donate. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much, and be well.